Well, welcome to today's webinar on how to prepare for Harvard. My name is Janae, and I am the Managing Director of Boston Global Communications, where we teach people how to communicate better at work. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today. And I want to congratulate you on getting into this amazing program. It's going to change your life. This I am sure of. It is a transformational program. I remember when I first got accepted into Harvard many years ago, and I was very nervous about everything. Like, how much reading would I really have to do? How would I compare to my peers? And what would it be like to participate in class? So over time, I prepared a workshop, and I do a lot of coaching with people to help them be prepared. So today I'm presenting 8 skills that will help you manage the workload and get the most out of your time at Harvard. And I would suggest you take notes because I'm covering a lot of material, and also notes increase memory. By the end of this brief webinar, I'll definitely show you some skills on how to read more quickly, how to increase your comprehension with really good notes, and how to understand study expectations for class. So you'll receive your first reading packet next week, and you'll see that you have 3 cases a day to do when you're on campus, and you'll have class 6 days a week. So it's wise to prepare ahead for the workload. You'll want to do as much reading and note taking as possible before you start. So that should come next week. You should be receiving an email next week with all of that. So these are the 3 big questions that I always get. Will I get through all of this reading? Will I remember everything I read? And will the teacher call on me in class? And the answer is yes to all of these questions. Preparation is really the key. If you prepare ahead, you'll be ready to go. Just like for a meeting at work. When you log into class or in the virtual classroom or you're on campus, it's expected that you're prepared to participate. Just like in meetings that you have in your own jobs, you know what the agenda is, you know what the purpose is, and you've read the supporting documents, and now you're prepared to discuss your position with colleagues. So it's the same thing at Harvard. You have to be ready to go as soon as you walk through that door there. You're given a schedule with key questions and the topic discussion for each class, and it has 3 to 5 questions usually on how to prepare and what to read. So this is a typical classroom. You'll have assigned seating. As you can see here, there's a name badges here. So you'll have assigned seating. And the faculty, that's me down there getting ready. The faculty will be up and down asking questions and bouncing questions off of one person to another. They'll say, Alexandra, Miguel said this. What do you think of that? And they'll go back and forth like that. So that's why it's so important to be prepared. The case method really starts with you. You need to read the case and understand the questions and be prepared to discuss the details of the case and what your position is. So when you read the case, you're put in the role of the decision maker, and you'll analyze each story. You'll examine causes and alternatives for solving the problem so that you have a set of recommendations for the protagonist to present in class. Then you'll meet with your learning group to discuss the cases for the next day. So you need to read the cases and take notes so that you can be prepared for that learning group discussion. It's called an LG. Your LG is a really powerful part of the Harvard experience. These are small groups that help you test your thinking and understand the details. You do not have to present together in class. It's really a discussion group to help you understand the case and to talk about different perspectives from the case. So it's like a warm-up for class. And you know, everybody benefits when you lean into the process and you're present and you're contributing to these group sessions. Then the next day, you're ready to go because you've read the case on your own. You can discuss and debate the details, and you've talked about it with your LG. So you should be ready to discuss it with a large group and with the faculty that wrote the case. So case studies are true stories about company challenges. There's characters and a plot, and it always leaves you with a problem to solve. So it's good to understand what the purpose of your reading is first. When you read a novel, you start at the beginning and you read slowly and carefully, and you enjoy the language. With business reading, the purpose is different. In business, the purpose is to present recommendations or to make some sort of a decision. So if you read the case like a novel, it will take you a lot longer. Your purpose for reading is in the questions that are in the schedule for each class. Next, you'll want to get an overview of the case before you dive into the details. It's like a helicopter view. So a helicopter view gives you the big picture and helps you see how long the case is and how the information is organized. So by understanding your purpose, Reading the questions and getting an overview of the case, it helps you chunk information and organize it, sort of like a filing cabinet in your brain. That's how I like to look at it. It's much easier to recall information when you have a system for organizing the information in your head. You can easily become overwhelmed, and you have something called circumlocution, which is when you have a whole lot of information and details running in circles almost in your brain, and you have no way to organize it or retrieve it because you can't remember where you put it because you don't have a system. So having an organized system for managing the information in your head helps you chunk it into manageable parts so that you can process it better. And that's what it means to be smart. Being smart means that you develop systems in your mind for thinking and processing information and then communicating that information. And these are skills that can be learned to help you think deeply, to go beyond the superficial, and take discussions to a much higher level of thinking. So I'm going to show you the 5 steps for reading a case that I like to use, and then I'll walk you through a case. I'll walk you through a case, but first let me show you what the 5 steps are. So the first thing is to read the questions. So you want to read the questions because, as I said, the questions set up the purpose of the class, and it tells you which direction that the faculty are going. It should take you about 2 minutes to read the questions, and it's all very clear. I'll show you some in just a second here. So you can look at a case from multiple perspectives. So you want to be sure to look at it from the perspective that the faculty wants. The next step is to read the titles in bold and italics. So the cases are written in many chapters. So it's broken down in titles and sections. So you go through the titles and then you step back and you ask yourself, what did I learn from the questions? What did I learn from the titles in bold and italics? You need to step back because you need your brain to register what you just did. And the real learning comes in the reflection of the learning. It's not just cramming it in there because it won't come out right if you do that. So the next step then is to read the introduction, the conclusion. So the introduction and conclusion set you up with the whole case. It introduces you to the people, the protagonists, and it leaves you with some sort of a question to solve. Then you go to the appendices. The appendices are visual documents, visual organizers, graphic organizers that break things down like organization charts and financial information. So if you do those first 4 steps, it'll take you about 15 minutes and you're going to know a lot about the case. Now, you're not going to know everything you need to know for the class, but it's a really great setup for your brain to now process the information and to do a deep dive. And then you should be ready to do a deep dive. So let's do it together. So here are the questions. So we're going to talk about the Colgate case, which is called Brighter Smiles, which is on your agenda for later in the program. So here's the question. So you see just 3 questions. Why is Crest White Strip such an important launch for P&G? Why is the company so excited about the opportunity? How costly is the entry of Simply White for P&G? How should Ismail respond to the introduction of Simply White, and what are his options? So that's it. Those are the questions. So that guides your reading now. So now you take a moment and you step back for just a moment and quietly think, all right, I just read these questions. So what do I know about the case so far? So that's what you do. You just step back and quickly register what you just did. So the next step is to read the title. So let me go to the case. Do you see my case? So here's the case. So we're going to go through together and read the titles. So Brighter Smiles for the Masses, Colgate versus P&G. The Oral Care Market, Colgate, Palmolive, and Procter & Gamble. Then Whiter Teeth, a primer, White Strips, Simply White. Moves and counter moves, and that's the last part. Okay, so that was easy. This is actually a short case. So you've just read the titles, so now you're building on your information. So what more do you know about the case now? So now we're going to read the introduction and conclusion. So I want you to all do this, and I'm going to call on one or two of you to ask you to summarize what you just read, just like Philippe did. So let's go through it together. So I'll just put it on my screen here. You blow it up a bit. And go ahead and read through it, and I'll scroll down. Okay, so you've read the introduction and conclusion. So now you step back for a moment. You think, all right, what did I just read? And you take 30 seconds to a minute to just process what you just read. Would anybody like to volunteer, or should I give you your first cold call? So now the next step is to go to the appendices. So you see how much you learn when you break it down like this into manageable parts. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time just because of the class time today, but let's just scroll through and see what we have. We have market share for P&G white strips. We have a lot of financial information here. Excellent. Yeah, and that's okay not to know everything. When you're doing the breakdown, you're starting big and then you're narrowing down into the details. So you have to be comfortable with that. You're not going to know everything right away. So you have to give it some time. So let me tell you about how the paragraphs are written as you do your deep dive. So the paragraphs are written properly. That means that every paragraph starts with a topic sentence that sets up the paragraph. The middle of the paragraph are the details or the body. And then the last sentence in every paragraph is a wrap up to the idea or a transition into the next thought. These cases are written, with committees, usually run by the faculty. And so there's a process to writing, as there should be, by the way, in all businesses. And we should all have good writing skills. So here's an example. So here's one paragraph that I took out. So the first sentence is, prior to the invention of white strips, consumers could choose between three methods to whiten their teeth. Well, what do you think the body's going to be about? The three methods. And sure enough, it is. Power bleaching was available, blah, 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 blah. Dentists made trays. And then Unilever introduced the third option. So you read through and see what those are. And then the last sentence is, unlike power bleaching or trays, the whitening agents contained in toothpaste came in contact with teeth for a very limited time, making toothpaste significantly less effective than the more expensive methods offered by dentists. So that's the last sentence. That's a wrap up. So that's the way it is the whole way through any case. So what do you think the two most important sentences are in a paragraph? The first and the last. That doesn't mean you don't read the details in the middle. Of course you do, but you read at different speeds. So you read carefully the first sentence, you skim the middle for the details, and read the last sentence carefully. Now, how do you remember all this stuff? That's the big question. Well, let me go through that. You have to break tasks into meaningful chunks so that you can remember what you read, just like with the reading, but you can do the same thing with your note-taking. And notes really support memory. So there's different kinds of note-taking you can do. You can do an outline format, like some of us learned in school, 1, ABC, 2, ABC, and so on. And then now we know a lot more about the brain, so we use a lot of visual diagrams, mind mapping diagram formats, split page formats, which I'll show you. And you should always have sticky notes available because I always have a bunch of sticky notes here. Sticky notes are color, and color intrigues the brain. It keeps you focused on what you're doing. Have color markers, and you need quiet. You need quiet to do cognitively demanding tasks. If you're interrupted all the time, you are not going to be able to reach higher level thinking. You can actually train your brain to not reach higher level thinking, but you don't want to do that if you're going to Harvard. So you need to find time where you can focus, which is a very valuable skill these days, focusing in chunks. So your brain thinks in images, not in words. So you need images and systems for thinking. Taking notes on lined paper with no images or blocks or organization just means that you have a river of words on several sheets of paper. And it's really hard to recall quickly when you're in a fast-paced class. And I'm sure you know what that feels like, when you're in a meeting or something and you have all these papers and notes. You want to have something easy to refer to quickly so that you can participate fully in the class. So the purpose of your notes at Harvard for these classes is to get the details. So here's one method. This is skill number two, the split page format. So the split page format is when you take a page, you'll need several pages for this, but at least there's some organization. You put the case name at the top. You put two columns. The smaller column is where you would put dates and names. And then the other column is where you would take your notes. Then you can put a summary of what you read at the bottom. Summaries are really important because it keeps your brain focused on the next step. Here's an example of how I started. I was talking about, or I was thinking about, the expected market. So I made some notes. I put jotted down what the opportunities were, and I started to list the names of people and the companies because I was mixing up the companies all the time. So I made sure to make a note of that. The next method is mind mapping. Mind mapping is a wonderful tool. It's really popular at Harvard. So unlike traditional note taking, where you list ideas with bullets, mind mapping helps you connect thoughts using images and color. So it allows you to use all of your brain basically to absorb and present information in a more visual way, like I say here on my slide. This is what a mind map would look like. All mind maps look a little bit different, but they all start with a circle in the middle of a page, and then you have some key branches, and that's where you put your keywords, and then you put your details with secondary information and so on until your page is full. It also helps you control the information, and you chunk it under different categories. And don't worry about where you chunk it because it's only on one page. So as you practice mind mapping or organizing with visual tools, you'll get better and better at where to put the information so that you can look on the right square, basically. So it's based on the way your brain naturally processes information. And since your brain thinks in images, not in words, it connects thoughts and ideas. And it starts with a key question or concept in the middle of the page. So then you can add related thoughts and connect to that thought, and it helps you control it on the page. It tracks also the natural progression of your brain and gives you a system for thinking. And that's what everybody needs. We all need systems for thinking. So let me play you this short video by Tony Buzan, who is the inventor of mind mapping, who I'm sure you've heard of. So I'll play you this short video and then we'll take a look at a mind map for this case.
Do you want to maximize your mind's creative potential and generate brilliant ideas? Tony Buzan is a best-selling author and world-renowned expert on creativity, learning, and memory. He has helped millions of people across the world unlock their potential with his intuitive thinking tool, the mind map. So, what are mind maps?
These are techniques for thinking that over 40 years and thousands of years of experience and research have been found to be the ways in which we think most effectively. And I studied neurophysiology, I studied psychology, I studied psycholinguistics, I studied pre-medicine, I studied the notes of the great thinkers, and I studied myself, what actually worked for me and what didn't. And over the 40 years evolved the mind map.
Mind maps are easy to create and effective. We start with an eye-catching central image in the middle of a blank page. We then create branches that radiate out from this image and reflect your ideas.
You start a mind map with an image in the center. Why an image? Picture is worth a thousand words, stimulates memory, stimulates associations, stimulates your thought. From the central image, the second law is main curvilinear branches. These emanate from the central image. Those main branches are curvilinear because thinking is natural, it's organic, and the curvilinear branch attracts the brain more. Those branches, which are called in psychology, in idiomatic language, the BOIs, the basic ordering ideas, are fundamentally the chapter headings of your thought. From those branches emanate, not hanging off the ends, but emanating from the main branches, the BOIs, the chapter headings, emanate these second level ideas. From those, the third level, from those, the fourth level. And very quickly you realize that the mind map as a manifestation of your thought is an infinite thinking process. You can go on adding branches to this branch forever. You can go on adding branches to this branch forever. So the mind map reflects the fact that potentially your thinking, your intelligences are infinitely capable of generation.
Add only one key word to each branch, avoiding phrases or sentences.
Wherever you can, and this should be basically everywhere, one key idea per branch. Why one and not two? Why not a phrase? The reason is that each key idea, each key word, each key image is like a little exploding supernova. So everyone radiates out associations. And when you're building a mind map, you want each one of those supernovas of meaning to have the freedom to generate ideas. If you put them in phrases, it's like putting your hand in a cast. You rigidify all the joints, which is what makes your arm and hand such a phenomenally competent tool. Similarly with the mind map, the single word per line rule actually gives you more explosive freedom, more explosive creativity.
To make your map more effective, you should use color and stimulating images throughout.
The mind map triggers. It uses color instead of monochrome. Colors, plural. Do you like colors? Of course you do. And a color is a thinking tool. It's not some childish thing. Color allows you to order, to discriminate, to code, to highlight, to generate thought, to remember. It's an ultimate thinking tool if used well, and especially in the context of the mind map. Images throughout. Same as for the central image, a picture is worth a thousand words. So if you have images throughout your mind map, then you are going to automatically have more powerful memory, more stimulation, more interest, more generative thought.
Mind mapping has been proven to boost your productivity, creativity, memory, and comprehension, and can be used for almost anything, from planning and organizing tasks to generating ideas and presenting. Visit our website at thinkbuzan.com to find out more.
I love mind mapping for case studies because you can go to class with that one page and refer to it there, and you can add things on the back of you. I'm surrounded by mind maps and I love them. I'm always referring to them, trying to find one I can show you. But you can turn it around on the back and put extra sticky notes, for example, and it works really well. You don't have to worry about using the technology because Harvard won't let you bring technology in the classroom anyway. Most faculty don't allow it. So you just do it with paper and pencil, which actually there is a lot of research to show that your memory improves if you do it with pencil and paper. So you take the questions from the faculty and you choose like the most important word or words. Like here I chose opportunity. I need to know why they're excited about this opportunity. I need to know about the cost and I need to know about options. So I would use that to set up my map. So that's what I did. I put opportunity, options, and cost. And then as I was reading, I started to add information that I would add more and more information. So that's how you do it. I put this on the back. I started to do that because the numbers are harder for me. So I made sure to list the numbers there. So the words on your map should really be the details that trigger an understanding of the whole story. You don't need to write out paragraph length discourse, and nobody's going to ask you for your answers to the questions. You know, you don't have to hand anything in, for example. You just have to be prepared to discuss it. And frankly, by the time you get to class, the faculty will be way beyond those questions. They assume that you've already discussed those questions, you've thought about them, and now you're at a much higher level in your thinking. So we looked at these two tools for remembering, the split page format and the mind map. So it takes two or three cases to get it right. You have to be patient if you're learning some some new skills like this or you haven't used them in a while. But it's really good for you back home too. Also know that you can't be good at all things. So you work with people who have different strengths. And that's part of the reason why Harvard puts you in these learning groups. And they really serve as a place for you to test your thinking and leverage the strengths of the group. Remember that skills require strong neural pathways. And so if you have a loose pathway, it just means you're not as strong. You need to practice. As you practice, your neural pathways get stronger. So know what your patterns are, develop skills for what you need to do, and then you'll be working with people who have different strengths. So let's move on now to discussion skills. So before I get into the discussion skills with class, I just wanted to go over networking and give you an opportunity to meet each other a bit. I'm going to put you in some small group breakouts for this. So networking at Harvard is phenomenal. You are going to meet the most amazing people that are going to be part of your career for the rest of your life. They're all going to be a support system to you. But networking is work. It's building relationships. So I would suggest that you have your LinkedIn profile ready before you get to campus. Harvard will keep you busy from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed. You won't have time to work on that kind of stuff. So you want to get that all ready before you go. So when you're introducing yourself, you have to work your name, enunciate your name. There's people from all over the globe. I forget how many countries. I think they told me 60 countries were in this group. I mean, it's amazing. It's a global group. Work to remember other people's names by repeating their name and get to know others. Ask one or two questions when you meet them and work to connect others. I'm a Harvard alumni and I can tell you I'm an alumni of several schools and the Harvard alumni are the best at connecting. So we're always connecting each other, or you should meet so-and-so because he needs communication skills. And he asked me and I thought of you, you know, so it's just wonderful to be part of the Harvard network. They're really supportive of each other and you'll do the same as you will be alumni. So when you're introducing yourself and others, have a 30-second introduction ready and spend 1 or 2 minutes with somebody. Make eye contact and smile and repeat the person's name. So I like these two techniques. It's not just saying your name and your title. Oh, my name is Janae and I'm the managing director of Boston Global. You have to say what value you provide others or what problem you solve. You want to engage and make people curious about what you do so that they ask another question. So I like these. Start with a question that addresses your target audience. You know how millionaires have trouble knowing where to invest their money? Well, I help those people by advising them on how to save first, invest second. Of course, you say your name, where you're from, but you want to say a sentence or two to say what you do. Or specify who you help and what they'll gain. I usually say this, oh, my name's Janae from Boston Global. I help people communicate better at work with skills they can use the next day on the job. And most of the time, people say to me, oh, we need you. You need to talk to our boss, or we need you in the sales department. They need to learn how to communicate better with us. So that's what you want. You want to engage people and get them curious about what you do, especially if you're trying to build business. So I want you to take a moment and think about your introduction. How would you introduce yourself and how would you say what value you provide? And I'm going to set up some breakout rooms and put you in those rooms, just in small groups so that you can meet each other. That was great. So if you can have 1 or 2 sentences where you can introduce yourself and show what you do, what value you provide, it makes it more interesting for people. So that was great. Good. So you can practice that. And as I said, remember to have your LinkedIn profiles all ready because it's a great way to connect with people because you'll have lots of connections to make when you're finished with this program. So now you're ready to go to class. So let's talk a little bit about those discussion skills that you're going to need. Remember that you're taking part in a discussion to learn and to help other people learn. It's to help examine issues. It's to share ideas and it's to listen to the ideas and the points of view of other people. So at Harvard, a discussion involves a lot of interaction. It's a willingness to share ideas and a willingness to respect other people's points of view. If you have some skills or systems for organizing your speaking, it actually improves your thinking and your listening skills. And it promotes your confidence level as well. It's a really effective tool in problem solving and decision making. And remember that you can't contribute to a discussion if you're not well prepared. It'll become quickly evident if you don't have a handle on the details or you're just speaking in platitudes. The faculty pick up on it right away. So let's move on to some skills for presenting ideas and engaging with others. We've talked about reading a case. I gave you 2 different methods for taking notes. So now you can remember what you read and break it down into manageable chunks. So you should be ready to go to class. I'm sure you've heard of the Harvard cold call, right? So you have to be ready for that. You will be called on in class. You have to prepare for class just as you would for an important meeting at work. It gives you discipline. This means that you need to have strong content mastery. You have to have critical thinking and communication skills. It is anxiety provoking, but it's also inspiring, I think. Remember that by the time you get to class, you will have studied the case on your own. You've worked with your learning group, and now you're at a much higher level in your thinking. So it's not just about answering the questions. The faculty assumes that you're past that. And now you're thinking strategically about how to actually solve the problem for this company. So whether you're with your learning group and or if you're in class, it's important to manage your speaking time. Linda Hill talks about balancing advocacy and inquiry, which means it's great to have opinions and ideas to show that you've read everything and you've thought about it, but you also have to show a spirit of inquiry. Inquiry means that you're interested in other people's points of view and you know how to ask questions. So a lot of people know a lot of things. They have PhDs. They've written papers. They have lots of experience. They've done research. They have a great job, but they don't know how to communicate so that people understand them. So Howard Gardner from Harvard talked about that in his book called Five Minds of the Future. And one of those minds, we're in the future, by the way, one of those minds is synthesizing skills, the synthesizing mind. And that means that you have to know how to communicate and persuade. He said, the synthesizing mind helps you make sense of what you learn and communicate it to others clearly so you can manage productive conversations. So it's an additional skill that you need to learn. So keep your comments short, build on what other people say, and speak clearly and concisely. So this is a great skill called tripling, our fourth skill. It's the rule of three. That says that a trio of events or characters is much more humorous, satisfying, or effective than other numbers. We're not sure why, but for some reason, the brain remembers three things in a sentence, and it doesn't remember more than that. So stop, look, and listen. If they're grammatically consistent, it's even better. It helps your listeners understand your point. So there you see they're all verbs. Or healthy, safe, and tasty too. Those are all adjectives. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are nouns. So these are things that rattle off. People know these things. Or blood, sweat, and tears. Churchill did say blood, toil, sweat, and tears, but nobody remembers the toil. So people who are really trained in media, like Christine Lagarde, for example, does it really well. And with practice, I do a lot of coaching on this. With practice, you can get really good at it. So you start out small, like with just verbs or with just nouns, which we're going to practice in a moment. But then you can start to build on that and you can make it more complex and it's much better. So take a look at this grammatically consistent phrase from Christine Lagarde. The best way for the banking sector to say thank you would be to actually have, and here she does it, good financing of the economy, sensible compensation systems in place, and adequate reinforcement of their capital. That's good advice, I think. But you notice that she uses adjective noun combination. So good describes the thing, the noun. A noun is a person, place, or thing. A good is an adjective is a describing word. So good financing, sensible compensation, adequate reinforcement. So you can get better and better with practice on doing that. So it's a good thing to know. How can you do one compelling sentence to really make your point? So we're going to practice just a little bit. So this is an easy question. And I want you to put it in the chat box and Philippe is going to read them off for me. What are three things you hope to get out of your Harvard experience? So go ahead and put that in the chat box. And Philippe, maybe you can share some as they come in. We'll just give them a moment to think. Again, what is your one compelling sentence? Think about that main point and then you can add a supporting sentence or two and a wrap up or transition into the next thought. So let's take a few moments to just think about listening, which is our next skill. So there was a study by Jack Zenger and Joseph Folkman in the Harvard Business Review that I'm going to summarize for you. Basically, the first thing is that good listening is much more than just being silent while the other person talks. In a conversation, they say that the best listeners are those who ask questions once in a while that promote discovery and insight into what the other person is saying. They say it's good to challenge, but to do so in a constructive way. Just sitting there silently nodding doesn't provide sure evidence that a person is listening. But asking a question tells the speaker that the listeners not only heard what was said, but they understood it well enough to want additional information. Good listening is then seen as a two-way dialogue rather than a one-way speaker versus listener interaction. And the best conversations are definitely active. The second is that good listening also builds on your audience's self-esteem. So the best listeners make the conversation a positive experience for the other party, which doesn't happen when the listener is passive or, for that matter, critical. Good listeners make the other person feel supported and convey confidence in them, and it's characterized by the creation of a safe environment in which issues and differences can be discussed openly, which it definitely is at Harvard. Thirdly, good listening is seen as a cooperative conversation. In these interactions, feedback flows smoothly in both directions, with neither party becoming defensive about comments that the other one makes. By contrast, poor listeners are seen as competitive. They only listen to identify errors in reasoning or logic, and then they use their silence as a chance to pounce or to prepare their next response. So that might make you an excellent debater, but doesn't make you a good listener. So good listeners may challenge assumptions and disagree, but the person being listened to feels that the listener is trying to help, not just trying to win an argument. And then fourthly, they say that good listeners tend to make suggestions, but they do so in a very skilled way so that the other person doesn't feel bad about it. Somebody who's silent for the whole conversation then jumps in with a suggestion might not be seen as credible. And somebody who seems combative or critical and then tries to give advice might not be seen as trustworthy. So asking questions and building on the conversations helps you to build trust with people, especially in your group. Let me play you this short video on listening.
Listening is just a vital skill in the business world because it enables you to really understand what somebody is saying, what they're feeling, what they're wanting. And very often, if you listen hard, you'll find something out that you didn't actually know that is very important to you. I once went to a client with a much younger executive after we'd done some research that we really wanted to explore with the client. And we went in and we had a very good session. We presented our ideas and we had a bit of a discussion. And we came out afterwards and I just kicked myself because I realized that actually what we had done was we talked at the client, and every now and then he'd been polite and he'd said something, and we hadn't learned anything. And so I absolutely believe that it's very important that you listen and you ask questions much more than you talk in any dialogue. And I think it was Mark Twain who said something along these lines, which is basically that you have two ears and one mouth and you should use them proportionately. But one of the things I found really helpful that I do now personally whenever I'm going to a client or any situation with a group of people is basically to ask them in advance, what are you trying to achieve? What are the objectives of the meeting? And very often people will just go into tell mode. They'll tell you that they're going to do this, they're going to do that. And I actually say, well, stop, think. Why don't you change all of that into the questions you want to ask the individual we're going to meet, so that you actually engage them in a dialogue. And in doing that, you'll learn a lot more rather than just thrusting the messages at them. It's very easy when you go into situations to have some either explicit or just unwritten assumptions in your head about what's going on in the situation. It's very key that you don't let those assumptions blind you, because people will very often do the obvious. They'll say, oh yes, that's very interesting, and they don't mean it at all. And you need to get beyond by asking questions. So if somebody says to you, it's very interesting, say, what is it exactly you find interesting in that? So that you're always probing beyond the superficial response. When you're listening to somebody and you're really engaging with them, you pick up loads of little signals about their body language, about what they're really thinking, and you ask questions that probe more deeply rather than just the obvious. Very often people say things and you know that there's actually a different conversation going on in their head. You need to ask questions to get below the obvious answers.
Great. And I love that expression. We have two ears and one mouth and we should use them proportionately. I think that's pretty good advice. So let's talk about questioning. You can tell a lot about a person's thinking by their questions. A study by Harvard by Tom Pullman and Neeti Thomas Proper point out in their study on communication that questioning has become a lost art. What they found was that 70 to 80% of kids' conversations are just questions. So adults are very different. For adults, it's only about 15 to 25% of the time. So why the drop-off? Well, at school and at work, we often reward people who answer questions, but not those who ask them. But questioning is a skill that can be learned, and we can learn a lot about questioning. So there are now lots of books on questioning that are wonderful. If you're interested in any of that, just send me an email, and I can tell you what they are. But There's clarifying questions like, walk me through your process starting from the beginning. I love that question when things get very confused and people aren't sure what to do next and who said what and all of that. You can do a journey map of what happened and you can ask that question. Or challenging assumptions. Is that always the case? Or probing. Let's go back to the evidence and check that. Or let's take a look at the data and look at the trends. Or exploring viewpoints. Does anybody else see it this way? And of course, consequence questions. How does X affect Y? Or what would happen if we did this or that? Which would be more like scenario planning. So let me play you this short video from Harvard on questioning.
Jumping to conclusions can lead to poor decision making. That's why it's important to take the time to ask more and better questions. But different types of questions can lead to different outcomes. So consider these four types of questions, each aimed at solving a different type of problem. Clarifying questions help us better understand what's been said. Questions like these help us avoid making false assumptions. Adjoining questions are used to explore related aspects of the problem that haven't come up yet. Taking time to ask these exploratory questions can prevent focusing too much on immediate tasks at the expense of the bigger picture. Funneling questions are used to dive deeper. We ask these to understand how an answer was derived, challenge assumptions, and understand the root causes of problems. Elevating questions help you zoom out. These questions take us to a higher playing field where we can better see connections between individual problems. In today's always-on world, there's a rush to answer, but you can't get the right answers unless you ask the right questions.
So true. So ask questions that engage your colleagues and encourage full participation by saying, hey, what do you think? Or can we get your reaction to this? Or would you be willing to share your views? And then always use diplomatic language. I see what you mean. Or I agree up to a point. And instead of using negative words like that's a bad idea, try saying that's not a good idea. It's always better to use the positive adjective with not. That's a little communication trick. So studies show that when you're attentive, you're empathetic, you're non-judgmental, you can actually shape the listener's emotions and attitudes. So let's take a look at this skill, which is how to present an argument. So a big part of the discussions that you'll be having with your group is to present an argument for what you believe in and make some sort of a recommendation. So what you don't want to do is just state your opinion and leave it. Like, he should be fired. You know, if you do that, you're going to really, the faculty will really come after you about why you think that, what reasons you have, what data to make your decision, and so on. So I like this four-step system. So first you say what your opinion is, which is one sentence. Then you say why you believe that thing. Then you give your data or facts or examples to support your claim. And then you wrap it up with an argument, which is how your evidence leads to your claim. So I'd like you to practice this. Let's practice this and think about what you believe in. So I've written two things here. So hybrid work models are best, or everybody in the company should have a learning and development plan. Or I need to read all of my cases before I get to campus. That would be an easy one to do. I'm going to put you in small groups again, and I want you to go through this and think, what is your opinion? Why do you believe that? What kind of stories or examples do you have to support your opinion? And then what's your argument? How does your evidence actually lead to your opinion? You did exactly the right thing. You stated what your opinion was. You gave a few reasons and some examples to support your opinion, and then you wrapped it up with an argument. So what you don't want to do is keep going, right? So register in your mind that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end with your comments. So if you're presenting an argument, you want to think of it like this. And when you're doing your case discussion, this was easy today because we're not doing an actual case. But for cases, you'll have a lot of evidence and data that will support your point of view so that you can recall that and use that. And the argument is sort of like the dun 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 dun. It's the wrap up to your comment. Everybody should be saying, oh, yes, yes, you know, I get it. I get that point. So there are different levels to thinking. There's a developmental level to thinking. The lowest level of thinking, this is called Bloom's taxonomy. The lowest level of thinking is stuff that you know. It's facts. It's when you read your case, you're at that level. So it's thinking, but it's not the highest level of thinking yet. So it's things you can memorize. It's tasks. It's who, what, when, and where. The next level is when you can describe it and put it in your own words. That's why when you go to your learning group or your LG, that's when you talk about the case. You can put it in your own words. And that's a good thing. That means you're reaching higher level thinking, but you're still not to the highest level of thinking. Then you get to the next level where once you start talking about it, you can start to apply it to what you already know and think about other situations and problem solve. The next three levels is pretty much where you're going to be in class. So they assume that you did everything else. You know what you're talking about. You have the facts. You've already discussed it with people and organized your thinking, chunked your thinking into some systems like I'm teaching you. And then you're able to analyze it. And that's when you can break things down and evaluate each part. And then you reach critique, which is a very hard, difficult part, because that's when you talk about what works and what doesn't work. A lot of leaders in companies and countries don't like to talk about what doesn't work. And you can have a lot of problems with that. You can get arrested in some countries for critiquing the leadership, in many countries, actually. So at Harvard, though, it is really encouraged. So it's encouraged to critique and to talk about the cases and to talk about different viewpoints. And that's when you can reach the highest level of thinking, which is where innovation takes place. This is when you create something new and you design and construct a solution. Innovation just means solving old problems in new ways. And that's what you're able to do. But you have to allow time and your brain to reach that higher level of thinking, because there's a step-by-step process. So when you're doing your studies, this is what you're doing. You're starting at the lowest level of thinking, and then you're working your way up. By the time you get to class, you'll be at a much higher level of thinking, which is called critical thinking. So let me just tell you a couple of things before we close about physiological needs, which need to be in place before learning can happen. You need to have 6 to 8 hours of sleep that's uninterrupted. That's when you get better work the next day. You need hydration, drinking water, and you need simplicity with choice reduction. We have a limited amount of cognitive resources in the morning, and information is distributed according to emotional intensity. So you want to be sure to have everything in place before you get up in the morning. You have your system all set. So at Harvard, they do that for you. They have your breakfast ready for you. They even have pencils and paper and markers and sticky notes in your conference room. Each of your groups will have a small conference room. So everything is taken care of in the ecosystem to help you be successful. It's just wonderful. It's set up for your success. So you have to do your part by reading the cases and preparing and having your notes ready so that you can be prepared to be in these discussions and participate fully in class. And sometimes you just need to take a deep breath. And of course, there's glucose and proper nutrition. There's lots of healthy snacks around the campus, and the meals are wonderful. The cafeterias have a big variety, so you can choose. And exercise. There's a wonderful gym. And on the first day that you arrive on campus, they'll give you a tour, and you can go and see the gym. It's pretty common at 3 o'clock to see everybody finishing classes and running to the rooms to get their sneakers, and off they go jogging outside. If you're there in the snow, as I think you will be, then there are tunnels so that you can go from one building to another if you need to. So it's all set up for your success. Let me play this short video on sleep, since sleep is the most important thing that you need to have for optimal performance.
So what I call basic hygiene factors like sleep, nutrition, hydration, and exercise, everybody knows that we should be doing these things, and it can be a bit like, yeah, of course I know I should sleep. But what we know now from the neuroscience research is so compelling that it really makes it more frightening to think about not doing those things properly. So let's start with sleep. If you have disturbed sleep overnight, so we're meant to have 6 to 8 hours of good quality sleep. There are some CEOs that say they only need 4 or 5 hours, and they're sending emails at 5 in the morning and they've already been to the gym. But that's not okay for most people, so that's not something to be admired and followed. Most people need 6 to 8 hours of solid, good quality sleep where they go through the various sleep cycles. If that gets disturbed at all, then you're effectively working with an apparent IQ loss of 5 to 8 points the next day. Now, most people watching this video can probably still do a really good job with 5 to 8 less, IQ points the next day. But an entire night's disturbed sleep, and that could just be a red-eye flight, equates to one standard deviation loss of your IQ the next day. Most people couldn't operate on that, whether you're a lawyer, a sportsman, a coach, you know, giving service to other people, you're really putting that at risk. What we know that happens overnight is that there's a system called the glymphatic system. So what I call basic hygiene factors like sleep. So, you know, I've done shift work as a doctor. I travel a lot, jet lag, you know, sleeping on planes. So I really try to ensure good quality sleep every night that I can. And the use of napping is also quite helpful. So a 20-minute nap is like literally plugging in your phone battery. It will just give you a power boost. A 30-minute nap improves learning and memory in the brain. And a 60 to 90-minute nap improves learning, memory, and actually encourages new connections to form, which can unleash creativity in the brain. So that's why Google have nap pods, I think, in their business. It's not because they're asking people to work all hours. It's because they would like to think that people are sleeping enough and improving their creativity if they need to.
Very good. Yeah, she's terrific. So before you meet with your learning groups, remember to read all the cases before you meet with them and be ready to participate fully. So no phones or recording. Turn on your videos, your cameras, so that it's like a face-to-face meeting, and come prepared to talk and listen and start on time and end on time. Usually 30 minutes per case is enough. So you have three cases, that's an hour and a half of meeting with your group. And you'll be able to take turns in leading and facilitating your group discussion. So we covered a lot of things today, and I want to know from you, what was the most useful thing you learned? If you could put that in the chat box, that would be great. We talked about networking and building relationships and how to introduce yourself in 30 seconds or less by focusing on the value you provide others, not just your title. We looked at reading skills and how to break it down into a 5-step process so that you can chunk it and manage the information as you gather more information in your mind. And then we talked about organizing that information in your head by having notes, like the split page format or mind mapping. Any kind of a visual tool like that is going to be really helpful. And then we looked at discussion skills, how to synthesize and to focus on the top 3 things, or how to reach higher level thinking and understand that you have to do your part in order to reach higher level thinking, or you won't be able to participate fully in those discussions. And then we looked at listening, questioning, presenting an argument, and optimal performance. So I hope it was useful for you. I'm going to stay on the line and take questions. I think we had a couple of questions, good questions come in. So I'll do that. But thank you if you have to log off. Thank you for coming today. I hope to see you all on campus, and I wish you all the best.